Well, hello everyone. Happy Sunday and welcome to Restoring Our Roots podcast, the voice of the decriminalized nature movement. This podcast is a gathering space where we explore the wisdom of entheogenic plants and fungi, the beauty of natural healing, and the importance of reconnecting to the sacred earth. Every month, we'll hear from visionaries, healers, and advocates who are working with entheogenic plants and fungi and returning us to a balanced relationship with nature. My name is Larry Norris. I'm the co-founder of Decriminalized Nature and the National Organizing Director. I've had the privilege to really help a lot of teams across the U.S. pass policy locally in their cities, so or counties even. So if you are interested in that, please reach out to us at decriminalizednature.org or email us at info@decriminalizednature.org. We have an orientation monthly to get everyone on track to figure out how to decriminalize in their local area. I'm thrilled to co-host this Decriminalized Nature podcast with our other board members as well. So you'll be seeing them coming up in the future. We do this every 2 weeks. We go live every 2 weeks. And I'd also like to introduce our behind the scenes guru, Rachel, who's been very instrumental in bringing this project together and putting all the production together. Thank you, Rachel, for your efforts. This has been a really important part of Decriminalized Nature, getting our word out there. So I really appreciate your help. Rachel's been going to be posting these episodes every other week on Spotify. So next week on Sunday, you'll see this podcast go on to Spotify and other platforms as well. Also, she'll be answering and gathering any questions, not answering, but gathering any questions and comments you have in the chat. So please leave some comments and questions for Dennis and myself, and we'll have some time to answer them towards the end of the podcast. So I'm really excited. I've had some really great conversations. I've always been enjoying watching your work, Dennis. And I have our guest today is Dennis Walker. He's the founder of Micropreneur. He's a satirist. He's a staunch mushroom advocate, organizer of, I think, kind of a new thing, or maybe it's been going on for a while, but this mushroom incubator idea, which we'd love to talk about a little bit as well, and recently a new dad. So congratulations to you. How are you doing today, Dennis?
Amazing. Thanks so much, Larry. Thanks also, Rachel, and everyone else behind the scenes. Hello to everyone listening. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm an open book. Let's rock and roll.
Great. Awesome. Well, maybe we could start off with a little background bio. Tell us a little bit about who you are and anything you'd like the audience to know.
Yeah, sure. So the elevator pitch is I grew up in San Diego, California, hosting a lot of exchange students. So had a pretty cosmopolitan, globalized perspective as a young lad. And I was an athlete. I signed a letter of intent to play Division I baseball at the University of San Francisco. Right around that period of my life, I became increasingly interested in altered states of consciousness. And this was pre-social media. This is going back to like 2005 when I started to get interested. So I was checking out books from the library and literally reading Tales of a Shamanic Apprentice by Mark Plotkin, who was a Yale ethnobotanist. And the more down the rabbit hole I would go, I just found myself uniquely gravitated towards plant entheogenic based healing in different traditions around the world. I started hearing rumblings and anecdotes from friends and peers about their mushroom experiences or about DMT. Then I discovered Arrowhead, Terrence McKenna, and I tried a half eighth of mushrooms when I was 17 years old. It was the most divinely inspiring, uplifting, yet somehow grounding experience. And I started to ask questions about why we had never learned about any of this. Why was this not a part of our pedagogy or curriculum growing up? How come nobody was talking about this in mainstream culture? And then I went to school in San Francisco. The lid blew off all of that when I discovered the legacy of the hate and the psychedelic legacy in San Francisco. Cisco, so on and so forth. And I'm still on an open-ended journey of inquiry and self-discovery that centers mushrooms mainly, but I'm interested in all the other molecules as well. So that's the brief pitch to you.
Great. Thanks, Dennis. Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, of course. It seems like there's, you know, for me as well, there's a sort of process of learning, like, wait a second, why are these things being hidden? And like, just mind-blowing aspects of like, why this is something that, especially for, you know, my interest was in consciousness studies when I sort of, you know, grew up a little bit, and you know, if we're talking about consciousness, like, what better things to really explore than these different substances that give us an opportunity to really ask questions about what is the nature of reality, what is the nature of consciousness, things like that. So when you sort of came across this, what were you getting, these sort of inklings of like there's something much bigger? What was your thought process around why was the mainstream was kind of hiding this? I know we have a lot of different sort of, we can, you know, you hear a lot of opinions on this, but I'm kind of curious your thoughts around why is it that this has kind of been repressed in mainstream society? And then also maybe speaking to how it's growing now and the different way than maybe, you know, sort of the medicalized model that you see kind of in the news versus some of this more consciousness expanding styles. So both why you think it's repressed and also what do you think is happening in terms of the current, we kind of spoke about this before, the current zeitgeist of medicalization and consciousness expansion.
Sure. Well, in my personal experience and in the peer communities I've been a part of, I would say that it definitely causes people to question the fundamental nature of the society that we live in, our role in that society. And for a lot of people, you see this kind of shift away from wanting to be a unwilling participant or a passenger in their reality to being in the driver's seat and trying to create their own reality. And I think that could, of course, be quite a bit dangerous to hierarchical power structures. Like you need, to a degree, some people to man the machinery and drive the cabs. And I always think it's funny. It's like nobody comes back from an entheogenic experience and says they had a breakthrough and they want to be a janitor, you know, or they want to mop up someone else's piss, you know. Like, so I think there is sort of an inherent danger there for the kind of system that we've been living in. Now there's another question to grapple with as we look towards automation now, and you start to see budget cuts and slashing all over the place. And, you know, I think Andrew Yang mentioned that something like 38 states, trucking is the biggest industry. Don't quote me on the number, but it's a huge industry. And we're going to have automated trucking in the near future. So you have this example of like, well, we're at a point in society where we're having to question a lot of these fundamental precepts and things we took for granted. So maybe this is a good era that we start really questioning our individual roles and the collective roles in society. So I think that's one reason it's been repressed. And you see a lot of misinformation and disinformation about psychedelics and about what they can do and what they can't do. You know, we saw this with the push towards decrim in California that came up, where there was a very unfortunate incident that was allegedly tied to a pilot who took psilocybin mushrooms 48 hours before. There's a whole rabbit hole we could go down there. But it happened to be the same week that Newsom was slated to sign the bill for decrim or for this policy ballot measure. And if you look from a certain perspective of what a coincidence that this high-profile mainstream story would come out and then cause the governor to veto that bill and to say, actually, there need to be more sensible guardrails. So, you know, you start drinking the Kool-Aid a little bit and you start looking at how come mushrooms and other substances haven't been brought to the forefront until it was the underground that pushed them to the forefront, right? Like they carried this work or this lineage underground in spite of prohibition and in spite of top-down information saying psilocybin is a Schedule I drug and it has no known medical value. So then the next component was there was this medicalization push, which really kicked off the quote psychedelic renaissance. And I think there's actually a lot of legitimacy to that because it opened the door to polite society and mainstream society being able to talk about these things in the first place. Now, when you have the FDA declaring psilocybin as a quote breakthrough therapy, and 2018 was when they designated it. And I think that was for a crystalline polymorph formulation, which isn't the mushroom, it's the psilocybin and a patented version. Nevertheless, it sort of legitimized the conversation. Now, FDA breakthrough therapy is designated for expediting an indication or a treatment for an indication. I think it's been 7 or 8 years since then, and there's been no progress made. And what's the most popular thing, arguably, in the nation, especially among more open-minded people, is psilocybin mushrooms. You see them everywhere. They're everywhere. Everybody has them. So I think it's time we be adults about this, have sensible conversations about it. And the last bit I'll offer here is I don't think that necessarily means that everybody should be doing them all the time. I think that's the other part of the narrative that's like, oh, these things maybe were stigmatized unfairly. Does that mean we go to the opposite end of the spectrum and that we have people dosing 5 times a week? I don't know that that's a good idea. So I think, you know, it's about time we had these conversations basically and debated them publicly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you touched on so many different things there, including, I think, we tried to squeak in a little bit of a news article right after Newsom vetoed as well, right around the same time as the pilot guy, but we passed in Eureka, and so we were trying to like alleviate some of that. We even tried to plan it out so like we could get it right around that vote time, because it was this, once that happened, there was this kind of, you saw the pendulum kind of swing a little bit in terms of the general conversation nationwide. And like everyone was picking up this pilot story and doing the exact same headline. You see like CNN and Washington Post and New York Times, blah, blah, blah. All these people are like kind of not really touching on it until that second to last paragraph where you see it says, oh, yeah, 48 hours before he'd actually taken the mushroom. So I always find that pretty funny. You talk a lot about this resistance, or this sort of this emergence, and you were speaking a little bit about how the underground was really holding this through the prohibition times, and I think most of us that have been engaged in this feel like that really speaks to sort of some skill set, some understanding, some knowledge, but there seems to be this big push towards keeping that away from the main, okay, we're going to put it with authority figures, medicalization. We're going to, in California, there's this bill that showed that only surgeons were going to be allowed to administer it, and totally denying that people have been doing this the underground or indigenous folks that have been doing this all over the world. So, what do you think that resistance is? It this need for authority? Is there this hyper suggestibility that's trying to, like, without getting too sort of, conspiratorial about it, why do you think it is that they need to dismiss the people that are really skilled in this? And I know you do this incubator, so you're meeting people all over the world that are super skilled in this, that don't maybe have these sort of credentials, that we see as mainstream science, what do you think that sort of pushes? You think it's just wanting to control it? You think it's fear? What's your sense of that?
Well, first of all, thanks for the opportunity for this conversation. And I very much try to keep an open mind and to have my positions challenged and to lean in with personal experience and what I've seen working in real-world case studies over a long period of time. So I think the hesitancy towards democratizing access to mushrooms and to saying, okay, everybody can have these legally, and instead wanting to camp them with this professional expert ideology is really a symptom of the medical establishment that we have and the pharmaceuticalization of that establishment. Wherein, for example, when I first got super interested in mushrooms, and everyone that I knew in my small circle of psychonauts, which has expanded over the years, nobody was doing this for healing. It was never, nobody said, I want to take mushrooms for healing. It was for visionary and creative purposes. It was for fun. It was to see cool, crazy patterns. It was to see what your mind's capable of. And I think that, in some regards, needs to be centered. And that coming with that is this idea of mushrooms for healthy people. Why does it always have to be that this is an indication and it's for PTSD or for depression? Well, if you put it in a box like that, it fits nicely into that pharmaceutical medicalized paradigm. And then there's a huge industry that you can build around it, right? You have to have training programs, you have to have licensure, you have to have insurance and overhead. And these are the same components that are derailing the access to a lot of this medicine. Everyone wants to talk about access. The access is already there, Larry. Like, it's so easy to grow the mushrooms. There's tons of churches and communities and decentralized models popping up. There's 18-year-olds who are growing a lifetime supply in their bedroom with small inputs, like not very much capital. So, like, of course, that's potentially injurious or threatening to an establishment model that needs to take the whole thing apart and repackage it and sell it to you. That's essentially what pharma does, right? It's like it'll take an active compound or an alkaloid from a plant, it'll extract or synthesize that alkaloid, like we're seeing now with synthetic ibogaine. And then, it'll target it towards one indication, it'll mark it up 2,000% and sell it back to you. Versus what happens if the mushrooms in the community are affected as they are? Because there's humongous amounts of data on this in terms of real-world examples of people saying, yeah, I tried mushrooms, for example. A personal example, I have a friend who had never tried mushrooms. He was about to become a dad for the first time. And he told me he really, really wants to try mushrooms. He's done his research. He probably asked me four times, and I was recalcitrant to give him mushrooms because I was like, yeah, I don't know. We're friends and we see each other socially. And I just would feel terrible because I'm not a guide. I made that very clear. At about the fourth time, third time, he asked me, I gave him some. After one single dose of a 4-gram chocolate bar, he quit drinking alcohol. He brought a baby into the world and told me that he was having trouble with alcohol. And he knew that as a new dad, he didn't want to be bringing that with his son into the world. Literally took him one experience with a chocolate bar with no therapist or anything. And again, this is a reasonable, healthy adult. That to me, it's sometimes an outlier when we talk about, like, we infantilize the conversation. Like, these children, they can't possibly make their own decisions. They need to go through $25,000 of therapy that insurance probably wouldn't pay for. So, last statement here is I think it is a false binary, like decriminalization versus medicalization. I think it's a both and, but the fact that there's so much emphasis and funding and media attention and hype put on the medical model detracts from this incredibly accessible, effective model that already exists.
Absolutely. I think the I often think about that. We as an organization aren't necessarily against those others as well, but we are if they don't decriminalize first or simultaneously, because then what happens is you can have that pharma now using the leverage of the law to arrest you for not buying their product. And as we see, it's not medicalization, but in Oregon, well, that's $3,000 to $5,000. It sounds like in Colorado, that's going to be something similar. And you mentioned something earlier too about sort of this doesn't necessarily need to be put down everyone's throat. It's like, hey, people are going to come naturally come into this, but with the pharma model, it's a business model. So they have to say, well, there's 200 million people that suffer from depression, so therefore all of them need to have this, substance to help with their depression. Well, maybe that's not the right approach necessarily. So I think there's just something too about that sort of the business model. Like, okay, we're going to try and like figure out exactly how much we're going to make here. We're going to figure out how to like, synthesize it down. I was even seeing the stuff where, they're talking about making psilocybin out of E. coli or something like that. It's like, why not just grow the mushrooms? Why are people coming up with all these new complicated ways to do something that's been done and easily done in closets, as you mentioned, by people all across the world. So, I think we're in this really interesting space where all these different sort of imaginaries or contexts or ways of working with policy or working with getting people access are coming out. And it's kind of interesting to see how they all kind of like go back and forth. Do we have to go with the FDA? Are we always going to have to have an issue with the placebo effect? Do we have to come up with new studies and trials for that? And in the meantime, like you said, people are growing this all over the place. So you talk a lot about, I guess you have this new thing called the incubators. Talk a little bit about that. And it sounds like there's some really interesting things coming out of that and people are coming up with new ideas. Is it more about techniques for growing? Is it more about people having new experiences, inner experiences they're talking about? What goes on at the incubator that you have?
Yeah, thanks for asking. We cover so much ground, and really it's just about people who are embracing mushrooms in their business. And that could be that they're focusing a mycocentric model where they're explicitly selling mushrooms at farmers markets or creating mushroom materials. Like we have a company from Canada who the founders come and they're doing travel purses that are made out of mycelium leather. We've had therapists come, we've had lawyers involved in various law firms that touch plant medicine and mushrooms. We've had the founder of MycoWorks come. That's a $700 million company. And he came and hung out, and there was eight people in the room, and he's dropping cutting edge intel about how he built a company, essentially. And we've had people who have been featured on Shark Tank, right? Like the name is escaping me at the moment, but we had the Terra Shroom, they're called, and their founder came. And it's just people like yourself and me who feel called to working with mushrooms in some capacity, getting in a room together and leveling up, sharing real world actionable insights. For example, I've got my MycoDay mushroom chocolate that I launched, and I'm not very good at the whole e-commerce thing, right? Like you have to do a whole bunch of back-end logistical work with the shipping and with connecting the Stripe and TikTok shop and things like that. People in the room usually have a TikTok shop. So I'll be like, hey, I ran into this issue this week with TikTok shop. What do I do? Oh, that's easy. Here's how I fixed that when I came across it. And really, that's what the Mycopreneur podcast was predicated on when I first launched it, was this idea of mushroom entrepreneurs. A lot of times, there's not that many in a community. It's growing, but it's like if you live in Ontario or in Long Beach or in Paris, like how many other mushroom entrepreneurs do you know? These days, maybe more, but especially 4 years ago when I launched it, not that many. So if you could all be part of a global community and have real-time access to each other, you could level up together and grow together. And just like the underground, that's a cool thing about mushroom entrepreneurs. A lot of them are open source. If they figure something out, they want to share that. Like we had a guy last week who's been doing potted plant casting using mycelium materials to cast. And it's a very innovative process. And other people who are interested in this process join the incubator. And he walked us through step by step. He goes, oh, I used the program Fusion 360. It was available for free at the local library. And then I was able to model this. And then I printed it. And this is how I did it exactly. Next thing you know, two of those guys, like including Tomas, who's a part of Oakland Hyphae, you may be familiar in the Bay with the organization. He is hosting another separate workshop about mycelium materials with someone he met in the incubator. So that's really all it is it's an excuse to hang out with other people who are working with mushrooms, who are solving problems with mushrooms. And of course, we get a lot of psilocybe pioneers as well. People who are involved with Triptomics often come, the founders, that's one of the nation's foremost testing labs for analytical potency testing. We have peer-reviewed authors who are publishing white papers on mycology. And that's all it is. It's trying to separate the signal from the noise and create a room where it's all signal and where everybody there is actively focusing on mushroom entrepreneurism. That being said, we welcome enthusiasts, activists. It's kind of a misnomer, the mycopreneur. It's like if you're interested in mushrooms, if you want to learn more, you want to hang out with mushroom people, you come to the weekly Mycopreneur Incubator. It's free. It's every Thursday, 4 p.m. East Coast time, 1 p.m. West Coast time. The link to sign up goes out in the Mycopreneur newsletter, which I'll I'll send along to you to hopefully include in the show notes. And that's all I want to do with my work is like platform and connect different mushroom entrepreneurs around the world and fast track this whole thing, because mushrooms are an amazing, amazing resource, and not just psychedelic mushrooms. That's a huge part of it. Materials, mycofiltration, food, there's mycotexture. There's companies building housing, out of mushroom mycelium materials. And I want to get all the brilliant folks together and collaborate with mushrooms.
That's great. Yeah. And when you sort of, I mean, obviously you're getting a lot of people in these conversations that are kind of talking about their vision. When you vision what's next after, let's say, okay, let's get rid of the criminal penalties first, because that's kind of a necessary thing. Of course, you're also talking about other types of mushrooms, not just sort of psilocybin mushrooms or others. But what do you see as sort of the next iteration? What's your vision for how this could look post policy issues?
I love the idea of decentralized, transparent, accountable communities. I think we're seeing that to a degree with the church model, right? It's the sort of like, you can't touch us, even though, as far as I understand, it doesn't necessarily have a legal basis. Like, if anybody really wanted to litigate against you, they probably could. And that being said, it creates a level of accountability within the community. And I think mushrooms are inherently decentralized. The fact that you can grow these with so many different inputs. And again, of course, I'm talking about psilocybes here in particular, but I like the idea of accountable community models. So, like, if you were going to try to regulate this, which I hats off to the regulators, this is a quandary. This is a tough one. I've been in the room with different Alphabet agency reps, and I don't know that they really have a clear idea. There's been different think tanks and different ideas of what if we did it this way? What if we did it that way? But at the end of the day, like, incentivizing education and transparency and community models, I think, is a winning combo. Like, for example, where I live, there is a microdosing store across the street. It's a hole in the wall. They're super chill. They don't have issues. And I've talked to them about the regulatory issues and whatnot. They go, oh, we don't even need to advertise online. We just host events. We invite our friends. If there's an outlier, like, inevitably you're going to have something happen. But if you have a critical mass of people who recognize the value, they're accountable to their community, that's how I would like communities to function. If there's a bad actor, community kicks the bad actor out. If there needs to be an intervention or something, I would say that's the exception rather than the rule. Most people are going to be low key. They're probably going to be too high to even do anything, and if they do have a public freak out or whatever, at a certain point, you gotta give people cognitive liberty. And that's been my whole take with like the illegality or the criminalization of mushrooms in particular. It's like, well, if somebody does something and then gets behind the wheel of a car because they ate 7 grams and they cause an accident, they're still guilty of breaking that law. Like, the mushrooms don't necessarily incur or shouldn't incur any kind of a criminal action. You're still subject to the laws of the United States after you take mushrooms. So, like, the whole idea of like, if we allow this, then people will do this. It's like, have you not seen the issues that are already abundantly in place in our society because of alcohol? Like, how many fights are happening after a hockey game? It's like that. To me, that's a sensible alternative, is community regulation, decentralized models, and accountability therein. And then if somebody wants to be a bad apple, which is inevitably going to happen, okay, well, then they're subject to the rules and laws of the United States. So again, I don't know if it's the best answer, but that's how I see a potential way forward here.
Sure. How do you see sort of the hedge against, we hear a lot of times about the hypersuggestibility issues around mushrooms, and you have this sort of charismatic leader and a kind of contend or trend towards maybe cultish kind of dynamics. How do you sort of do checks and balances for that when you have this sort of church model that's coming out? Because you see a couple places here and there that are doing that. What's your take on that?
I think that there's an important role that the press and journalists play. And I think also, unfortunately, because of the business models that are in place with a lot of media, they incentivize jumping on these adverse events and bad stories and potentially amplifying them even more than they need to be. Like, if something happens, it should be addressed and it should be publicly disclosed and written about. But does that mean that we need 65 outlets to run stories for 3 weeks on the Diamond Shroom scandal? No, not at all. Like, of course, that's a salacious story. If it bleeds, it leads. A pilot may have been triggered by psilocybin and takes a plane down, which, of course, there's been a lot of refutations there. Like, he also was drinking, and that's been disclosed. So it's like, did that not get any kind of mention that alcohol could have had a role here? I think he was
Did
on
he break up
prescription.
with a partner recently too, or something like that? So,
It
like,
was just very convenient that it was like, oh, it's the mushrooms and this whole matrix of social environmental factors. We're going to isolate and pinpoint this one thing. And I've got a lot of thoughts about that. And anyways, getting back to the idea of like the cult dynamics, it's something I discuss a lot. I think I'm very wary of it personally, but I also recognize that this should be an option for people. And like, if there is a culty situation, usually there's a forum publicly where that's disclosed. Like, if you look at Reddit, you know, there's all kinds of watchdogs that are talking about different brands or different figures, right? Like, you should do due diligence. And I think that in the effort to quote idiot-proof society or like make it so safe for everyone, you end up causing people to walk on eggshells. You end up restricting access. You end up doing more damage, arguably, than if you give people the benefit of the doubt with cognitive liberty, which again, I think moving forward in the age of automation and machines, we probably want people to start exploring other ways of living because we're already being tasked with needing to completely overhaul our worldviews. Like, look at what's happening right now. You know, we have advanced science and we can't even agree on what the science is. You have like, you know, top level funded institutions that are bickering back and forth about, well, that data is flawed and that data is flawed. So like, I do think we need to start questioning our epistemologies, our worldviews, and our ontologies. And I think mushrooms are a great way to collapse those, almost like a controlled demolition. So like, you know, whatever's happening now in the world, I'm not as concerned necessarily because I feel like I've already gone through a sort of collapsing of my worldviews and then kind of been able to reinvent myself from that. And to me, that's what the ego death experience is so profound with, is that you can completely, all the things you thought you knew could disintegrate in front of your eyes, and then you wake up the next day, or you know, you go through that process and you have to fortify and create your worldview again, being a driver of it and kind of guiding the process instead of being a participant who's just along for the ride. And I think a lot of people now are assigning a lot of the challenges in their lives to these macro narrative levels and meta figures that actually they've never met. You know, it's like, I've never met half of these politicians, so like, why am I going to spend so much time so concerned about that when I can also create my own reality? Maybe that's the libertarian in me, Larry, but that's where I'm at right now.
That's fantastic. Yeah, you know, it almost seems like too the whole sort of the dynamic of church and sort of cultishness could almost be because that's how the DEA requires it, right? You got to have your ministers, you got to have your book, you got to have your, like, they try and put so much dogma into this, and everyone's like, well, the book is eating the mushrooms. Well, that doesn't really fly with the, you know, it's like the way that they sort of force you into this also kind of creates these dynamics where you have to have this leader that maybe could, you know, be, you know, doing all the different things. So yeah, I think even the system that it's in sort of begs the question about why these sort of different cultish dynamics can emerge. And earlier you're talking a little bit about incentivizing education. Now, education is something that we hear, you know, oh, we need more education, we need more education. But then you look out there and there's like all these places doing education. How would you recommend getting someone to do education? So, for example, I talked to somebody the other day and she's like, oh, you know, we need more education. And I was like, okay, tell me a little bit more about that. And she's like, well, when I was at a party when I was young, you know, somebody gave me a bunch of acid and I didn't know what to do. So, this isn't somebody that was in the bubble looking for the education. This is someone outside of the bubble. How do we provide education to those folks outside of the bubble? I like, for example, some of the stuff you're seeing in Colorado with the Decrim model, where they're doing this gifting approach, where it's like an hour of education and you get mushrooms at the end. How do you see sort of encouraging education for people that are totally clueless? And then also, what is education when you really can't have informed consent about an experience that's beyond your mind anyway, if they've never had it before?
Yeah, I think that last part you hit on is the most accurate. Like, a lot of the education programs that I'm seeing are very much being created with a capitalist bottom line incentive structure, from what I can tell. It kind of follows the model of university education in some ways, which you'd say, like, universities aren't capitalist. It's like, I don't know, man, I paid $50,000 a year for my university, and I didn't because I got aid and scholarships and all that. But like, the idea is like, you come and learn this, and we put this model together, and then we train you for a clinical experience. And again, I don't think it's an either or. I think that should be a model. But what I look at is I look at global society. I think a lot of the current inputs for how we're approaching these problems are very unique to this sort of late stage capitalist Western perspective. And that's one worldview of a world of different cultures and societies that we can look at. So that's part of why I've launched Global Psychedelic Week. That's going to be November 2025, because having traveled a lot, having dropped in on different places around the world, you see radically different approaches that work for different people in different places. For example, in Berlin, drugs are all over the place, you know, but a lot of the Berlin people I know, they're extremely healthy, they're extremely fit, they're happy. And maybe that's a self-selecting sort of demographic that I'm part of. But like, I think about in the suburbs I grew up in, everybody's so scared of this drug or that drug. Like, to go away from psychedelics for a second, like, people I know who are very, very healthy, successful in Berlin are recreationally doing amphetamines. And when I grew up, and especially like going to school in San Francisco, I would think like you do methamphetamine and you're strung out, you're a junkie. There's an archetype, right? So when you see other cultures doing it differently, it forces you to rationalize or to confront those stereotypes you have to be like, oh, well, it's not universally true necessarily. So I think we can borrow from the wisdom from different places and apply it as we start to mainstream psychedelics. Now the question, should we mainstream psychedelics? And I'm back and forth on this. Like, A, I think we should have the dialogue and the education and the resources available. They should not be swept under the rug and driven down to a dark place, right? They should be available. But I always talk about one particular story. A good friend of mine, first time I ever talked about mushrooms, I asked, "Have you ever tried psilocybin mushrooms?" He goes, "Oh yeah, I got naked and punched a cop in the face." And that's a pretty extreme experience, but I've learned over time. Like, there was another friend, we were on Hippie Hill, and he had a freak out on LSD, and the paramedics got called, and there was a reality television show filming. It was an absolute zoo. People that, so these are pretty isolated examples, but I do understand the need at some level, especially as a regulator, for like putting guardrails in place. And how to do that most effectively, anybody's guess. But I think we can look at different societies around the world and we can borrow from them. And that's where the communities come in. There should be different types of communities where these experiences are available. Maybe some people want to rave. They want to go out, they want to rave, they want to have their group together. And that's really healing. I've heard a lot of people from different companies and camps that will remain nameless talking about how they healed on the dance floor, right? Like, they healed outside of a clinical pharmaceutical model, yet. And our current iteration of where we are in society, we need to route things through the FDA approval process, apparently. So it should be an either or. There should be different communities available, and there should be some transparency and open public discourse. And we should always follow the money, too. That's the last bit. We see these quote watchdogs and self-appointed, "I'm a watchdog." We're just so concerned about, the role of these different companies and stakeholders in psychedelics. And then you start looking at the paper trail and you're like, wow, you're extremely concerned, maybe more concerned than any reasonable person would be. I think you follow the money and that, and if it doesn't lead you anywhere, fall back and be a cognitive libertarian and do your thing in your small little group of friends. That's what I've tried to do by and large.
Right on, awesome, yeah. And you said, and I think this is, I think you're probably one of the few people that I know that has a global perspective. You've been talking to people from all over the planet about their different approaches to mushroom work and et cetera. And you said they're sort of radically different approaches. Is there like kind of, have you seen like an archetypal feel like in this area they talk a lot about this conversation in this area? Is there a connection to culture in that kind of way where you can start to peek out or to piece out like what exactly their sort of local cultural context is by how they refer to the mushrooms or the inner experience or et cetera?
Yeah, I think the main case study, I guess, I have is probably in Mexico, where I've spent a lot of time. And of course, this is the cradle of psilocybes. And there's more known psilocybe species in Mexico, I think, than anywhere in the planet. And there's a robust culture that goes back millennia. And it's not a big deal to a lot of people here. Like, I've heard the perspective of like, for the grandparents, this is their folk medicine. It's not this new psychedelic renaissance. Like, Cuernavaca is where Timothy Leary had his first psychedelic experience. That was in, I want to say it was 1961 or right around there, right? And Cuernavaca has a mushroom tradition going back millennia. So, like, Leary had a psilocybe experience before he had an LSD experience. So, you could say in some ways, like, that ancient mushroom kind of kicked off and opened the door to a lot of what's known in the West as the psychedelic renaissance. And that's not even to address Gordon Wasson and Maria Sabina and so on and so forth. But this has been an option. And it's been also hunted in broad daylight. The people who were providing these options, like, they were literally purged, right? They were hunted and tortured, and the colonizers and the Catholic Inquisition would call it witchcraft and devil worship. And now we're circling back a couple hundred years later, and we've got Johns Hopkins and Harvard and Imperial College London touting psilocybin as the future of mental health. So I do think there's a huge missing component there of paying attention to what came before us and not having to reinvent the wheel. This idea that, like, we just introduced this program at this university and we just graduated our first class and now they're published academically, so they're somehow an authority on these subjects. To me, that's the pinnacle of a lot of hubris and a lot of ineffective approach. And I think it's going to show itself to be that in the long term. If you're looking at like problem solution, and it goes back to the whole medicalization without looking at the broader cultural context in which these substances were administered. And I think that's where I look at like the Mexican communities I'm a part of. I know a lot of very esteemed mycologists who are working at a world-class level, publishing academically. They don't even really try mushrooms or psilocybes. And if they do, it's like, oh, that was interesting. You know, it's just there's so much more that goes into healing or living a healthy life than what we've made it out to be, I think, in the West, which is magic bullet. You know, we have depression and PTSD, then we take this, it's going to cure that. Like, that is a great sales pitch if you're trying, you know, if you're trying to bring people into your program or your center or whatever. Maybe it works for some people, for sure. Like, I think you could call it a medicine for sure, but at least some of the communities I've seen, there's just like a much broader, more comprehensive perspective. So, like, oh, you want to do a psilocybe mushroom retreat. All right. Well, why don't we first go out into the woods and study ectomycorrhizal fungi? Why don't we see the way the mushrooms fit in this ecosystem? Oh, let's cook lunch with our grandma and we're going to make mushroom dishes of different Pleurotus or wild harvested species. Well, here's some traditions in the Lacandon cosmology from the indigenous Lacandon people. Here's what they say about the Amanita muscaria. And it all of a sudden becomes a much broader tapestry and you're connected to a community and you're part of an ecosystem as opposed to this siloed off approach, which we have in the West, which is like you come in and you get a therapist and you lay on a couch and it's your individual duty to heal. I think we're missing that broader component of a comprehensive culture around these substances, in particular mushrooms. I hope at least some of that made sense. I'm kind of flying off the cuff here as
Yeah, no,
usual.
it's great. Yeah, I love flying off the cuff. So let's pivot a little bit and start talking about sort of these inner experiences. What you know, we like to think, you know, we have these experiences. You talk about there's this individualized thing, there's this community sort of thing. When we go places in our inner experiences, you know, there's a lot of conversation around we're going to a place. And others, it's this is just in our mind. You have someone like Kalindi, who I know you know plenty of, I'm sure, would like, you know, set up a rug and like he would say, this is where the ancestors are. This is where this is where this is. And you can go to that place. And other people could also go to that place. What's your sense of consciousness beyond after mushroom experiences you've had or people you've spoken with or indigenous traditions you've kind of been engaged with? What's your sense of consciousness beyond what we're seeing here when we go into these mushroom spaces, especially these big, deep mushroom experiences?
This is my favorite question, and it's one that we don't nearly discuss enough as a culture. Again, like microdosing has taken front and center, and microdosing is pitched as it can help you with addiction and this and that. I think that's very valid, but like I'm really missing this conversation about high dose experiences and about consciousness beyond our everyday waking consciousness. It's almost like it's taboo to talk about. You know, if you bring up high dose experiences, it doesn't really get the attention that it deserves. And Kalindi is one of the few who really brought that to the forefront, at least in you know, psychonaut circles of discussing that. Terence and Kalindi, to my knowledge, are the main two people who have discussed extensively their high dose personal experiences. It's probably shifting more now. Paul Stamets used to talk a lot about how he, on a high dose mushroom experience, cured his speech stutter. Like, what's going on there? You know, that's a famous story about climbing up to the top of a tree and then being able to look people in the eye and speak clearly. Like, there's clearly a lot going on that we don't really have the lexicon or the language or vocabulary for right now. So, as far as my own experiences, that's really what sucked me into the mushroom experience and interest in mushrooms overall was these high dose experiences. And when I was 18, I had a 7 gram solo dose in a dark, silent room. And I wouldn't necessarily, again, advise that for a lot of people. I think you have to make your own decisions and do your due diligence. And I didn't go into it blindly. I had read Food of the Gods. I had had a baseline of experience with low doses. Anyways, I really wanted to see what it was all about and push the envelope. I didn't really even have any kind of guidance. It was like, hey, you can get eighths from the person you know. So 2/8 is more than 5 grams. That's what I'll do. And about 45 minutes or 50 minutes after ingestion, I started seeing perfectly formed hieroglyphics streaming down the walls. And it was this mind-blown scenario where it really, for all intents and purposes, dawned upon me that I was communicating with some kind of advanced intelligence. There was no other explanation for it. I had never seen characters like this. They were at once familiar and of a totally alien language. Maybe they were arabesque. Maybe there was some Mayan hieroglyphics or hieroglyphs happening. And That one experience right there showed me the visionary potential of accessing states of consciousness that are very organized and intelligent and advanced that go beyond anything I had previously experienced. So that comes to mind immediately. There have been several occasions where the future has been shown to me. You could call it divination and a very specific order of events of, hey, this will happen. And I could go into details there, but I'd rather spare them. So that is simply on my end, recognizing that there's something here going on that we don't really understand. I don't think we will understand it for a long time. Maybe the singularity will come and it will all be abundantly obvious, but I currently have no frame of reference for what these mystical experiences are. They're mystical experiences. Now, one other one I'd really like to share. I was at Maria Sabina's family house in 2010. She's got a place, as many people know, in Huautla de Jimenez, which is kind of what kicked off a lot of the beatnik generation, a lot of these people going up to visit her, right? And Gordon Wasson, so on and so forth. And then there's all kinds of legends. Who knows how many of them are true about the Beatles visiting and Bob Dylan. One thing's for sure, lots of these seekers went there. So it kind of died down after the 60s. Like the Mexican military actually put guards at the base of the mountain because so many hippies were going to visit Maria Sabina. And then it kind of fell off the map. Like you didn't hear people talking about Maria Sabina, at least in mainstream society in the 70s, 80s, 90s. 2010, I was reading Reality Sandwich, the website, which is still around. And that was like the only website at the time that was doing daily psychedelic content to my knowledge. I was in Oaxaca City and there was an article published about Huautla de Jimenez. It kind of refreshed this idea. And I realized, I bet it's close by. I can go up there. So I went and got a combi, like a little colectivo by myself, 6 hours up the mountain. And ended up figuring out it's not that hard if you really look for it, how to get to Maria Sabina's place. Again, I don't advise going there with 50 people rolling deep. I went by myself, you know, and then ha talked to them and was like, hey, I'm super interested in mushrooms. I have some experience. I'm here. Would love to learn about Maria Sabina. I will also leave if that's not cool. They were so cool about it, Larry. They were like, oh, you want to stay? Yeah, why don't you stay the night here? You want to do a velada? You want to do a ceremony? So I ended up staying 2 nights and I had a mushroom ceremony, a velada that one of her relatives conducted. And during that particular experience, I had an out-of-body experience. And again, I had this sense of maybe I'm not fully in control here. Maybe there's a lot going on that we don't really understand, but there comes a level of surrender. And I feel like when I surrendered there, that I was able to kind of slowly ease back into, quote, a sense of control. But the humbling aspect of being like, whatever is going on with psilocybe mushrooms at high doses, there is an advanced intelligence there, and it would behoove us to at least try to responsibly and respectfully listen and connect with this intelligence. And at the same time, not think that it's us, that like, oh, because I had the experience, I'm God. You know, that's a very common issue too, is people get ego amplification. And I like to satirize that as well. Like there's the idea of ego death, but for some people that means like, I have seen the universe and the universe has put me in charge. So that's a whole other sort of like box of chocolates to grapple with. But those are just a handful of experiences I wanted to share. And in particular, if I were to put details on that, I remember that my eye was paralyzed and I wasn't able to move my left eye. And that's a very scary feeling when you're like, I've literally been possessed. Like you read about possession or whatever. I'm not able to willingly blink my eye. So whatever has this hold or this trance on me is kind of writing the rules right now, and I should probably, you know, respect that and recognize the power of what we're playing with or what we're, you know, in concert with. So again, how does that extend to authorities regulating mushrooms? I don't know, but I think there is sort of like I'd like to say a higher intelligence that's available, and if you want to communicate with that, you should do it, but you should also take responsibility for your actions and not just assume that it's all roses and rainbows all the time.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You talk about your experience that you had, the big experience. I wonder how many people have a similar big experience at the beginning that breaks them through to the other bigger experiences. Because for me, same thing. I had this really intense, my first like probably 7 gram bag as well. I thought it was bunk, the mushrooms, it took a little while to like kick in. And so I was like, oh, this is not happening, And then when it hit, bam, hit hard. And the same third thing was like, it was like a Rolodex of symbols, and I was reading them through my temple just by going back and forth, right? And it blew my mind. Like, I was like, what is this information? And of course, I'm not even able to really conceptualize it, but there's something there, right? And it was in Ann Arbor, Michigan at the time, and we're going to school there. And I just would walk around the town at 3 or 4 in the morning just to talk to somebody. Just be like, does anyone even know what just happened there? Because it did feel like this, for me, mind-boggling. There's another information source there. I'm having a conversation with something. There's something beyond me. It was just, and I was studying neuroscience at the time, so that was a pretty drastic, head trip for me, studying from something like everything's in the mind to being like, oh, yeah, everything's outside of the mind, right? So I wonder how much of folks that are starting to get into this really kind of access this information place. And we learn things from it without even really knowing what we're learning. And that sort of helps to develop our sense of travel, if you will, or exploration, or willingness to go beyond these larger doses and things like that. So that's fascinating to hear that. You also spoke a little bit about not really being able to put some words to this. And we often hear the term effing the ineffable, like, don't even talk about it. We can't put words to it. You might as well just forget it altogether. But that, I don't think that's helpful. We need to be in communication, especially if we're talking about something so much greater, so much farther beyond us. What are your techniques or how do you figure out how to put words around stuff that seem ineffable? Or do you just kind of also just let it lay? And sometimes I paint, that's helpful. But what's your way of uneffing the ineffable?
I love this question so much, and this is where satire comes in. As I learned through my own experience, that the mushrooms seem to be very fond of satire. Like, there's a sense of humor. There's this, you often hear from people who have a profound psychedelic experience talk about how they were just laughing uncontrollably. Like, the most simple thing, they saw kids playing in the leaves or in the park, and it made them just laugh and cry. So I think that being able to respect that degree of mysticism is very important, and to cultivate a healthy respect for the ineffable. As far as like trying to extract or draw some kind of insight from it, my understanding that the Wirakuta, if I pronounce that wrong, I'm so sorry, but the Mexican or Mesoamerican tribes who do peyote pilgrimages, they have something called twisted words. And twisted words are a way of communicating with the sacred, or talking about the sacred, without directly trying to name or signify it. So, for example, when they're doing a peyote pilgrimage, they'll say that cars are boats, and they'll say that the desert is the ocean. And that's part of the pilgrimage, right? You don't just, like, at least in those traditional societies, like, give someone mescaline. It's usually like you're part of a pilgrimage, and there's this whole sense of preparation. There's a journey involved, and that's part of preparing initiates for it, is using twisted words to speak in poetry or in symbols. And that the same thing, like when you enter an altered state or a trance state, it's very, very difficult to describe it to someone, but you might be able to communicate that experience through painting, through art, through music. So it's the twisted words idea. And it turns out, to segue into satire, that it seems to work very well for these experiences as well. Like, the fundamental role of a quote shaman or curandero in a lot of cultures is to use their lens of experience and to help people expand their own lens of experience. And you can do that with humor. Like, a lot of the medicine people are very funny, or, like, they're functioning from a level of very inadherent to social norms, where they're, the medicine people kind of live outside of the social norms. And, like, look at Rafiki and the Lion King as an archetype. He's batshit insane, Larry, but the guy's the healer, and he can see things. So there's something about, like, deconstructing your regular sense of perception and logic of, like, this is the way the world works, because A plus B equals C. When you go into those altered states, those laws arguably no longer apply. There's a whole different set of codes that are going on. So I think that one way to F the ineffable is to codify it by using twisted words, or by channeling it into art. I also think that's why music and these different artistic mediums are such a big part of psychedelic experience. Like, almost any culture has a sound component. Now, some people would say, do it in darkness. I think you should try it in both. I think sound can really intensify and pick up visions and add color to it. If anyone's done a ayahuasca ceremony, there's usually a singing component, or with peyote, there's rattling and songs. With mushrooms, there's a lot of songs. And you talk to the healers, and they say that the mushrooms taught them the songs. Like, they're speaking directly to these enchanted beings and communicating in a way that is maybe more favorable to, you could say, the spirit realm, which again gets into kind of intense woo-woo territory. But if we can't talk about it on the Restoring Your Roots podcast, where can we talk about it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, I think I love this idea of the we would kind of talk about the twisted words you say. Yeah, it's like, how do you you're not going to find the nugget. because the nugget is often relational. We don't have words for that, or it's beyond ourselves, you know. But you can kind of get around the nugget by playing with stuff. And I think this also speaks to the idea of sort of the trickster element, which you're speaking about with the satirists. And you see, tricksters are also at the core of transformation, cultural transformation, personal transformation, cosmological transformation. These are people that are trying to like shift things by showing you one thing to show you another thing, or taking you one direction to take you to another direction. Speak a little bit about your transition. You kind of mentioned a little bit your transition into satire, and how that sounds like, when I watched your stuff now, there's so much good stuff going on there and so much humor. And we talked about this at the Discovery sessions last year too, about how humor is such an embedded part of these experiences. Maybe talk about how you're transitioning into satire and what you see in that realm.
Yeah, so I guess I was born for it. I was the class clown in high school. I was elected, and I never really considered myself to be a comedian or anything. I always just kind of looked for the opportunity or the silent, awkward, silent moment in a group dynamic and then tried to fill it with laughter or like point out something that's absurd. And it came kind of second nature to me. I've always been a huge fan of South Park and The Simpsons and Danny McBride and kind of like this punchy, dark satire. I think satire is really good for examining darkness. It's like if you tell funny Eddie Murphy poop jokes, and I love Eddie Murphy, but he just came up right there off the cuff. Like that's one thing, that's stand-up comedy. But satire, it's like you can take on really politically charged, tense, dark scenarios. And I think that is a fundamental part of the psychedelic experience. Like it's the whole binary code or use the force, Luke. It's like there's the light side. We'll talk about that. But like there's clearly a dark side to a lot of spirituality or psychedelics as well. Like you look at the tradition of brujeria in the Amazon and like witchcraft. And so they're two sides of the same coin, but it feels like humor can go to places that are off limits to a lot of other rational discourse. And in doing so, you mentioned the jester. There's this idea in the actual Renaissance, not the psychedelic Renaissance, but like the European Renaissance, that the jester can say whatever they want. They have the jester's privilege. And my understanding through kind of studying this after I was anointed with this role, I didn't really claim it. People just started telling me, "You are the jester. This is you. You have the jester's privilege." And I started pushing it as far as I could, and I'm still trying to push it because you can say things that are not allowed in polite, acceptable discourse. And you look at, again, South Park. Like, how far have they pushed it? Like, so far. And so, as far as like the jester's privilege, yeah, you see this archetype pop up in different cultures, like the Hiokka, I think it's called, that is the coyote in Native American folklore. That's a trickster. It's someone who lives outside of social norms. They sort of roast the sacrificial lamb. They kill the sacred cows. It's like, oh, this is too holy to be discussed. Well, the jester is allowed to do that, and the role there is because if the king or the power structure or whoever were to execute the jester, then it's essentially validating what they're saying. But ceremonially, by allowing the jester to have that jester's privilege, you can say if it's said in jest, you're allowed to do it. And this also applies to like the First Amendment and to, if you want to satirize a company, like if I were to come out and name a major biopharma company and say they're doing this, this, and that wrong. Not that they would care about me, but you open yourself up potentially to litigation or to slander or this. If you do it satirically, and if you put the disclaimer that it's satire, you basically get a free pass. Now, there's probably a First Amendment lawyer out there that would challenge me on that, but from my pretty exhaustive study, it seems to be if you code things and couch them in satire, you're allowed to kind of say whatever you want. And you just have to reiterate that this is satire. So even some of these kind of like ideologues on Twitter or on X that are speaking about very intense and controversial geopolitical subjects, they oftentimes will say, "This is for satire," and then they'll tell you exactly what's happening. But when it has that label, it's like, "This isn't truth. This is BS." So I realize, like with psychedelics in particular, it and mushrooms, they lend very well to BS because you have these people, including myself from experience, you get these grandiose visions about the way the world works, and then you have to proclaim it to everyone. And like, "I have discovered that sound is made of time and I can prove it." And then, the next day you call someone and try to tell them, they're like, "What are you talking about?" It's like, "Come into my head and tell me it ain't true." But the satire, if you do it that way, it's like, it's fun. And at the end of the day, my last bit I'll close with here is like my friend Batu, who is an amazing AI VR pioneer in England and works with Breaking Convention and all these different awesome psychedelic programs over there. I ask him a lot of these things about like, what does AI mean like for humanity? There's a lot of correlation between like psychedelics and advanced technologies, I think. And he's like, well, it's infinite possibilities, but the most important is to entertain them whilst enjoying a martini. And I think that's where satire is. Like, we can look at all of these crazy conspiracies and archetypes and potential, but if you get sucked into those and you start believing all of your own BS and everything that comes to the surface during a trip, that's a recipe potentially for getting sucked down a rabbit hole you can't come back from. If you take it with a grain of salt, a sense of humor, and the last little bit I'll add here. I love Terrence McKenna. He had a huge impact on my life, as so many people. But like sometimes he kind of sounds like a raving schizophrenic lunatic, you know? And like a lot of the things he was point blank saying were just accepted as truth without anybody ever like questioning them. You know, it's like in 2012, the I Ching
Wave
and this.
Bureau, yeah.
It's like Terrence, scale back a little bit, bro. Have a martini, smoke a doobie, like, you know. And I love Terrence. I want to reiterate that.
Definitely. Yeah, the Time Wave Zero got a lot of play, and then of course, as anyone as it puts a deadline on it, that is like, I almost see that as the universe tricking. And as soon as you put like a deadline, a date for something, they're like, that's never gonna happen or whatever. But in theory, it was interesting, the idea of time information doubling at a very fast rate, which is great. So we talked about a lot of stuff today, but I know that there's something that just came up recently for you, your new dad. So tell us a little bit about that, and what's the relationship between that and sort of the insights and knowledge you've gotten from psychedelic experience. Have you been able to translate anything into the process of watching a newborn grow, and what's that watching consciousness come into being?
It's been the most awesome thing ever. It's something I've wanted to do for a long time. And finally, it became like, I guess we better get started with this thing with my wife and I. So, you know, there's been a very solid foundation in terms of our relationship. And I think that's really awesome in terms of having the best possible start for this kid. And it is a trip. You know, there was this, I think, Johns Hopkins study or one of these studies where they're like, you know, out of all 30 people who were parents, liken the psychedelic experience to their childbirth. It was flipped on its head for me, where it's like I had a ton of psychedelic experiences, and then I was having a childbirth experience for the first time, which is a psychedelic experience. And I feel this sense of responsibility first and foremost, but just humility and gratitude for the opportunity. Actually, I hit a K-hole in Budapest in a five-star hotel over the summer. It was like a really cool random opportunity, and I just went in for it. And one of the main takeaways I had, you know, that was my first like proper K-hole. I've come close before for sure, but that, you know, when you hit it, you hit it. And I came away with this takeaway, like, that's your job now, is like raise the kid. You know, all the other stuff, like, cool if your micropreneur works out or if this or that, but like your job is to take care of that boy now. And you know, that's, it sounds profound, you know, it's pretty straightforward, but there's something about viscerally feeling that, to be like, this is my job now, and it's a blessing, and thank you for that. So, you know, we're just getting started with it, but it's an amazing experience, as many people can attest to. And I'm completely in love with Winston, with my boy. And yeah, you know, I don't feel the sense to like go join a cult or, you know, be a microdosing influencer right now. It's like I kind of am gonna just stay in my lane, just be funny. He's got a bunch of mushroom pillows. You know, I've got little lion's mane pillows and Amanita pillows for him. And, you know, I'm friends with people who have been part of the, let's say, second generation of psychonauts whose parents were psychonauts, in some cases, very prolific psychonauts. And I'm not going to be like pushing these things upon my kid. You know, I think I'm not going to hide them, but I don't think that they need to be necessarily introduced in one way or another. Like everyone has to try them. Like, you know, I want the kid to be a kid, and that's hard to do these days. So I have lots of other decisions I have to make as a parent. Like, when do we get the kid a phone? Should he be a 4-year-old with a Snapchat? I don't know if that's a good idea. But at the end of the day, with anything, including with tripping or with parenting, I think if you display humility, you ask for help with your community, and you show up for other people, that it's gonna all tie together, hopefully. And I'm very blessed so far, Larry.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, and I'm sure you hear from so many people, myself included, of how great it would be to have a parent that is involved in this. So when we do, when he does grow up, or if anything, he decides to go ahead and explore, there's someone like you to actually sort of tap into, be like, hey, what do you think about this? Like, I think there's a lot of people who yearn for that in life, because there is this sort of, the stigma around it, and we haven't quite gotten there to the point where parents and children are able to have this sort of open conversation. So I think that will be something that I imagine will be pretty great because that's something that I know I had always hoped for. My folks are not necessarily into this world at all, so there's always that sort of headbutting that happens around this conversation. So I'm sure that'll be something that would be quite a privilege for him to be able to sort of talk to you about some of the strange and unusual places you can go, or even just how to do it in a good way. So
Yeah, it's
congratulations.
going to be different for everyone. It's going to be idiosyncratic, and I think that's where the whole support groups are good. There's actually a couple. I might be on a panel. I don't think it's been approved yet about psychedelic dads. I know some people pitched that for psychedelic science and asked me to be on it. And like, you hear more and more about like microdosing moms, but like, dad's got a role too there. So, and I know another friend of mine and colleague, Adam Bramlage from Flow State, who is involved with a lot of stuff in the Bay Area, he told me he's going to be working on sort of a men's group for fathers specifically. And just the last bit, I think that it's very important to have those containers because we've come out of a tailspin of the last few years of somehow like thinking fatherhood or, like millennials shouldn't have kids. The world is screwed up. Don't have kids. And I reject that narrative wholeheartedly. I think people should have them. Not necessarily everyone if you don't want them, but like that for me, the whole idea of like, it's so expensive. All that kind of goes out the window when you decide that that's your job and that's your role. That's what you want to do. It's like you find a way. I know people who have five, six kids and they're doing fine because that's what they want to do and that's what brings them joy. So the idea that it's too expensive and the world's too damaged, you shouldn't bring kids. I reject that narrative wholeheartedly.
Yeah, we need some kids out there that are going to help to shift the new narrative anyway, or right? The new paradigm. So that's good to have those out there. So congratulations on you and your wife and Winston. Wonderful, Winston. Welcome to the world. I think we have about 5 or 10 more minutes. Rachel, I don't know if you had a question, and then we'll just follow it up with any last comments you have. Rachel, why don't you go ahead?
Yes. So we have about eight people watching between Rumble and Odyssey. Just the really nice comments about your perspective, Dennis. The levity and the humor behind it. I feel like Cosmic Giggle came up somewhere. But my question's actually for me, just because you brought up the hieroglyphics and the images, and I've done high dose mushrooms, like I think 10 grams I've done with my husband. I haven't never done it alone. But my question is that I found astrology through doing psychedelics, coming from a really religious background. But what I was kind of like told was that this is all a beautiful big cosmic story, right? And your little blueprint, you get a call to do these things just because it's like you chose to come here. And I do think that there are individuals who are called to take that hero's path, go into the darkness, like be the like the pioneer into that those psychic worlds and like make a path for others to follow. So, Dennis, do you have any advice for those who have like that inner call to like delve into those worlds and like how you manage to kind of sift through and be like, oh, that means I should take a 7 gram mushroom trip. So, do you have any advice for anyone who's like, like those inner calls, those inner like mystical feelings about like there's something else going on in the universe. Any advice for anyone who has that feeling?
Yeah, not a medical professional,
No,
not
this is
financial
not medical at
advice.
all.
Yeah,
This is just
I
like
think
magical stuff, right? So
it's
deep in the
really
woo.
magic. It's magical stuff. I think that trust yourself, you can do it, but that don't blindly jump into it. Like if I'm going to go scuba diving to 100 meter depth, probably shouldn't be my first dive, like jump in the ocean first, like dabble, take
Yeah.
a half gram of mushrooms, see if that's your first time, see how that goes. Wait a little bit, like I like to tell people that, okay, my first dose was summer of 2006. That was 1.7 grams. And I was in a good place mentally. I was with friends. I had a wonderful experience. I feel very lucky about that. So it wasn't a microdose, but it wasn't a macrodose. And then I waited like 6 months. I didn't jump back in and say like, oh, I'm going to do this next week or whatever. Like, see how it shows up in your life.
Yeah.
Then take a little bit more, right? Tell people you're going to do it. Tell your friends or your wife or whatever. Be like, I'm going to do this. See how that goes. Then once you've been, let's use the scuba diving metaphor again, like, okay, I've been to 10 feet, I've been to 30 feet, and this came up and I figured that out. Okay, now I went to 60 feet. If you want to go to 100 feet, it really helps to have that sort of baseline of experience. And then, yeah, let's say you do have that. Oh shit, I'm seeing hieroglyphics. I'm time traveling. The future is being shown to me. Like, I would strongly advise against making any kind of like immediate response or reaction to that. Like, for me, I prefer not to have my phone because I've learned that the hard way years ago that like I just had this insight. I better call this person right now or whatever. I don't recommend that. I recommend like wait, chill. Okay, the next day, give it some time. In 4 days, if you still feel like quitting your job or whatever, maybe that's better than like
That's my take
I
on
feel
it,
like
at least.
all these little tips should go in like a little handbook, you know, like a little bit, like, you know, like just little tips for like delving into magical realms.
I like it. We need more high dose
Yeah.
journeyers, I think. And yeah, do your homework. Yeah.
Yeah, and I, you know, 4 days is even short. I often heard 2 weeks, 2 weeks before you break up with your partner or quit a job or anything like
Make
that.
any
Get
rash
some time.
decisions
Take
right away.
some time.
Yeah,
Yeah.
right. Awesome. Well, this has been really great. Dennis, tell us more about what you're working on. It sounds like you got the micropreneur thing, you got the incubator thing, you got this conference that's happening. What other things are happening? Or maybe just give us a little bit more depth of how to find out about all that from you.
Yeah, totally. So every week I put out a new podcast on Fridays, which is sort of the flagship property of Mycopreneur. And that's a different interview with a different mushroom entrepreneur. We cover tons of bases, tons of actionable insights about what's happening in the mushroom world and the mushroom entrepreneurial world. So every Friday that goes out on all the platforms, it's Mycopreneur Podcast. The newsletter I'm focusing a lot on this year, that's Mycopreneur Newsletter. That's on the Beehive platform. I share it on all my socials. And it also just aims to keep a finger on the pulse of what's happening in the global mushroom entrepreneurial ecosystem. And then the incubators every Thursday, that's been just an incredible result just from the 6 months we've been doing it. And like I said, we've had heavy hitters, and like, you know, people will pop in the room and go, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe that person's here." And there's like eight people or, you know, 15 people in the room, and you can pick their brain and get their email and pitch them on projects. So like, come hang out with us. Everybody's welcome. That's every Thursday. The invites go out in the incubator, sorry, in the newsletter on Thursday mornings. I'm on all the socials. I do daily satirical reels. I'm working on one right now. Just improv satire, trying to kind of, you know, bring some levity into the space and examine some issues critically through the lens of humor. So that's Mycopreneur Official is the Instagram. And if you just Google Mycopreneur, MycoPreneur, you'll find me everywhere, mycopreneur@gmail.com. And then lastly, I'll talk about Global Psychedelic Week. I think this is going to be an absolutely remarkable event. I'm one of the co-organizers, along with Melitza, who runs Psilocybin SF and Bizdelics and a couple of other platforms. We've got over 160 speakers who have applied so far from 30 countries on six continents. So we're really trying to globalize the narrative and the discourse. I find like so much of what's happened in the psychedelic renaissance is basically the US, Western Europe, Canada, Israel, Australia renaissance. And we've got speakers who have applied from places like the United Arab Emirates, South Africa. We had one from Zimbabwe, Japan, Argentina. So that's the focus, is like we're going to have top tier speakers that you probably are familiar with who are doing keynotes already. But then we're trying to bring in all of these other different folks who are also part of the global society and who have a rich history of psychedelic use or connection in their cultures and really platform and value what they're saying and highlight it. And that's going to be November 2025. I think the exact dates we haven't nailed down yet, but it'll likely be the 3rd to the 11th or in that general timeframe. That'll be announced soon along with the speakers. You can find out more info at globalpsychedelicweek.com. And please hit us up and let us know if you want to partner. We've got a ton of community partner organizations, and it's going to be a really awesome event. So I'm very excited about that.
Awesome. That's great. Yeah. And we'll put all these in the notes as well. So, Rachel will add those to the bottom little blurb there. So, if anyone wants to connect and reach out, please do. Dennis is amazing, as you can hear from this great conversation. Lots of humor, lots of fun, lots of knowledge. Really been appreciating this conversation and looking forward to many more conversations in the future and more collaborations and such. So, thank you again, Dennis, for being here. Reminder, everybody, every 2 weeks we'll be going live. The next, podcast is going to be Sunday, March 2nd. We're going to have a special guest, Julie Barron, who's a co-founder of Michigan Psychedelic Society and Decriminalized Nature Ann Arbor. And next week, you'll find this episode on Spotify, or about a week, a little bit over a week. And we'll put this on Spotify for you to check out this episode for those who weren't able to watch it live. So thank you again, Dennis. Really been a pleasure. Thank you, everyone, for listening in. Have a happy new year. Thank you, Rachel. And until next time, tune in, stay rooted, and let's grow together.
Plant power to the people. Plant power to the people. Where you dream is where I'll meet you.